Thank you very much. I'll voice thanks for time.
Thanks for that. Yeah, I was just about to say, great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Liz, for inviting me. I was meant to come a couple of years ago, I think, at the meeting in Bradford, but unfortunately I was unwell. So thank you very much, Liz, for inviting me back.
Not just me, it's the whole committee.
The whole committee. Everybody, thank you. So, yeah, Liz has asked me to talk about Buddhism and peace building, which is a subject that I've been studying, I guess, for about the last 20 years on and off, really started working with Tibetan communities in Northern India. Of course, Tibet-China question was always being discussed, and then I sort of more formally moved into that research area, having worked with Buddhist peace builders in Nepal, Myanmar, Thailand, Sri Lanka, several other countries. So I feel I'm here to represent those, really. I mean, I don't speak for myself from a sort of particularly confessional point of view, although I've been a sort of very bad Buddhist for probably about 30 years. But really, it's about trying to relay some of the lessons I've learned from working with those people in situations of conflict, really, that are the ones who are actually dealing with those situations of conflict. So, so I want to begin with a story, if I may. I am going to move this, hopefully, to discussing and making some comment on the UN system towards the end. But really, before the coup in Myanmar, the last military coup in 2021, I worked with a colleague in Myanmar for about 6 years, Professor Anna King. We worked on a range of peace building projects supporting different grassroots up to fairly high-level dialogue between politicians, capital representatives. But one of the projects really that particularly sticks in my mind was one working with the United States Institute of Peace, and they were actually developing a Buddhism and peacebuilding curriculum. And the idea of this curriculum was to bring together Western ideas of conflict transformation, peacebuilding, and try and marry that together with Buddhist concepts and ideas. And I think one part of this project was we went to Yangon for about a week and trialled this curriculum with young Buddhist peace builders and activists. And it's really the lessons I learned from that process that is going to form the sort of basis for this presentation and the kind of wisdom and lessons I want to hand on today. So firstly, and I will bring it back around to these lessons later on when I'm talking about more broadly about peace building, was the young peace builders acknowledged the importance of Buddhist philosophy, teachings, a practice for peace building, but also recognised the value of peace building methods from outside their own religious and cultural context. As I said, I'm going to come back to these, but so I do want to try and ask you to keep them in mind. But I think it says something really important about Buddhist ideas, traditions, and the syncretic and kind of flexible nature of Buddhism as a religion and Buddhist societies. The other thing we noted really was that facilitators and young people were really skilled and effective at synthesizing alternative peace-building ideas with existing religious and cultural ideas, stories and teachings. Again, I'm going to come back to this, but really it speaks to the importance of context in peace-building. And many of us here who've been involved both theoretically and practically in peace building know that for effective and sustainable peace building, context is so important. And really what was happening was these young people, as they were learning about peace building ideas, they were actually automatically translating them into their own context and culture. So they were imbuing these teachers with local traditions, teachings with local traditions, local stories. So they were overlaying their own religious and cultural ideas on top of this, which actually was doing the job we were meant to be doing in a much better and more effective way than we could ever do. And lastly, relationships, ideas, non-violence, interdependency, sanctity of all sentient beings were just inherited in their understanding of peace building and worldview. So that's just really noting that, again, I think us as outsiders were asked to come up with this curriculum. It was me, a couple of colleagues at the United States Institute of Peace. we were sat down, we were thinking very carefully about how Buddhist ideas of interdependency or the three poisons would marry up with Galton's idea of the conflict triangle. Actually, again, you know, this wasn't necessarily the young people, the Buddhists, the peace activists, they just did this naturally. This knowledge was inherent in them. And actually, even to the point that sometimes they said, well, we're not really interested in Buddhist ideas, we want to learn about Western ideas. But as they were learning about them, they were actually translating them and overlaying their own innate Buddhist cultural and religious knowledge on top of these teachings. So, saying something about the nature of peace in Buddhism, I think it's quite important as an underpinning. This is a quote often attributed to the historical Buddha. Peace comes from within. Do not seek it without. However, if we look at Buddhist scripture and philosophy, there's actually a lot of teachings where, and this is probably the stereotypical idea of Buddhism, this idea of inner peace, cultivating inner peace, detachment from the material world. But actually, there's plenty of teachings within Buddhism that actually relate inner peace to outer peace. And this is one example, the Chakravarti Sinada Sutra, where the Buddha actually gave a detailed narrative illustrating and emphasizing the direct link between poverty, social injustice, and how supportive social and communal ideas were really important for the development of inner peace. So the two are intimately interrelated in Buddhism. We can't have one without the other. There's also a Buddhist concept of dependent origination. It's been mentioned already several times today that that knowledge of interdependency or belief in interdependency between all different beings. And this is very much part of Buddhist traditions where the concept of dependent origination is really the understanding that we all exist in relationship with each other and we can't actually exist without that relationship. But not just between humans, coming back to our last talk, between all sentient beings, between all creatures, and how important that life and link is between all different beings. And lastly, the concept of the bodhisattva, this is particularly in Mahayana Buddhism, where the enlightened beings, or bodhisattvas, some of you may know about this, most famous example, the Dalai Lama lineage, they're believed to be the reincarnation of the Bodhisattva Avalokitesvara. So these are enlightened beings, but actually rather than choose to go off to Nirvana and escape that cycle of rebirth, they've actually taken the Bodhisattva vow, which is the choice to come back and be reborn on Earth in order to help all other sentient beings achieve that sense of enlightenment. So there's very much a strong tradition within Buddhism, of that sense of helping others, our interdependency, interconnectivity. And I just wanted to make that point rather than, I think, peace within Buddhism was often seen as this abstract ideal of meditation, isolation, rejection, non-attachment. But I think within Buddhist traditions, and actually certainly in the liberal religion, this is a very different experience for most Buddhists. And this is probably most evident in engaged Buddhism, which is a philosophy of practice, as it says there, that integrates spiritual beliefs with social action to address root causes and suffering in the world. Sorry. I don't know why that's happening, sorry about that. So, yes. It's just a really, let me check the time and what prompt is about. It's really just to emphasize that, again, within Buddhism, there's a really strong tradition of peace building, social action, action on the environment. And we have strong traditions within this, across all different traditions. There's plenty of centers of socially engaged Buddhist peace building, Buddhist peace building centers. And there's a few examples of the Tibetan Center of Conflict Resolution in North India, International Network of Engaged Buddhists, Buddhist Peace Fellowship, amongst others. I mean, really, this is just to emphasize the point that there's a a strong tradition of peace building and conflict transformation within Buddhism. So, sorry, I'm rushing through this bit because I want to get to the points at the end, really. So Buddhist resources for building just a sustainable peace. So what are those traditions, ideas within Buddhism that really can support on the ground very much practical conflict transformation and peace building activities? So Buddhist concepts such as non-violence, compassion, the sanctity of all sentient beings, dependent on origination, are intimately embedded in the cultural and social consciousness of Buddhists and Buddhist society. So these are some of the things that really make working within Buddhist societies and communities really make those opportune environments, I guess, for developing peace building practice. So I think within those good societies, what becomes evident when you work there on the ground is actually people have really absorbed. These are inherently innate ideas that are actually really fertile ground for peace building and conflict transformation. Also, the syncretic and adaptable nature of Buddhism as a lived tradition enables Buddhists to accept and take on new ideas. So again, when we're working with Buddhist communities on the ground, it's really open to fertile for new ideas. I actually got sent this a couple of days ago to emphasize this by a friend. In the bottom left-hand corner, world's first robot monk devotes himself to Buddhism, which is I guess, one example of that ability to adapt. So the relative authority and influence of religious leadership. So still within Buddhist communities and societies, religious leadership is still influential. Again, this goes from high-level religious leaders down to communities, grassroots leaders. You can really sense, even for young people within communities, the religious leadership and what religious leaders say really has influence on people's behaviour and attitudes. One of the examples of this, I suggest, is Tibetan Buddhist communities. And spent quite a long time within Tibetan Buddhist communities in India. It's actually really startling what an influence the Dalai Lama and actually other senior religious leaders have on even young Buddhist attitudes and behaviours. Several times I had conversations with young Buddhists saying, yes, you know, we will actually turn to violence against Chinese occupation, and there's a number of stories about training camps that have been set up in northeast India, Buddhist insurgencies being prepared, Tibetan insurgencies against China. But actually, as long as His Holiness Dalai Lama is alive, we'll never turn to violence because he's asked us not to. So I think you can see this within Buddhist communities across Southeast Asia, that there's still a very strong sense that religious authority and influence does have an influence on people's daily lives. The next point is religion is not distinct from other facets of life, politics, social ideas, conceptions of peace, economic systems, justice, etc. It's an inherent and indivisible element which informs people's worldviews. So again, this point has peace building practitioners and seeing this on the ground is the fact that actually, when you work with religious actors and influential religious actors, they are also accessible and have relationships with other actors within society, so they can be really powerful tools for influencing other parts of political systems, economics, okay. I can see, sorry, I'll come to an end.
This was our poem. When I'm waiting in the wings, they know to stop talking.
Yeah. So I've got two really quick slides, sorry, I've kind of slightly brushed through this. I think the point I'm trying to make.
May I just say, please finish in those 2 minutes, and then if you're just going to be available for questions, maybe the public Q&A on this, because our next presentation is actually being live streamed from South Africa. So we have to be quite careful about our timing on that. So please finish, catch your breath, and then don't go away during tea time. I'm sure there are going to be people that are like to speak with you. Thank you.
That's absolutely fine, thanks. So just to summarise really before I finish saying something briefly about UN systems. So the Buddhist context may look, this is a quote from someone called Sutta Anand, who was an engaged Buddhist peaceful activist and professor. The Buddhist context may look conducive to peacemaking at first, but it can easily generate a high degree of frustration. Like all lived religions, Buddhists are embedded in complex social, cultural, economic contexts. You know, we can't determine how Buddhists are likely to act or their attitudes toward peace or violence from abstract scriptures. Of course, their influence is highly within their context, whether that be religious leaders or their own social, economic conditions. So, therefore, self-evidently, wars and violence are no less prevalent, unfortunately, in Buddhist countries than in many other countries throughout the world. That said, I think for the reasons I've tried to suggest in terms of leadership, adaptability, etc., I think Buddhist countries and Buddhist societies and communities, in my experience, are really fertile ground for peace-building ideas, that their ability to absorb different ideas, adapt them, transfer them into their own cultural and religious context, act on them with religious leaders, networks. So there's huge potential, I think. And there's many studies, I haven't added them on here, that really show that Buddhist communities are highly, have high potential for peace building. Understanding the context and the ways in which different Buddhist teachings and traditions manifest. So really coming back to that idea of context, linking it up with the initial workshop I was talking about, the reason why that was so successful, and I think the peace building activists and young people made that peace building curriculum so good, was precisely because of this, because as we were learning about it and developing it, it was really all about their own context. They automatically translated and embedded it within their own traditions, ideas, stories, songs, even. So it wasn't an abstract idea of what Buddhist peace building might be able to achieve, you know, in terms of the Four Noble Truths or the Three Poisons. It was very much rooted within context. So I think like many of us here today, we've all had some experience of working with the UN systems. I myself have worked with UNICEF, UN Genocide Prevention, on a guide for religious and traditional actors on preventing hate speech. We worked with UNICEF on hate speech program, actually. I think someone mentioned earlier about the UN should get engaged more with religious leaders and actors. In my experience, there's a lot of that going on at the moment. Almost every UN agency has got an initiative where they're engaging with religious leaders. What I would say, I think, and actually UN Environment Programme as well, we've been involved with in advising on the conference there. I think what I would say is that it's being done too ad hoc, because UN agencies, they don't know who's doing what. I think it's done on a very abstract level, in terms of it's normally about gathering a group of senior religious leaders in a room, asking them what they think about faith, and then drawing it up into a set of guidelines. Whereas actual real effective peace building work happens on the ground, like I said, in grassroots contacts with people doing the work and relating it to their own context. So, yeah, I think there's actually plenty of work going on within the UN that needs to be improved in a much more joined up way. So, thank you very much for listening. That was a kind of a very quick overview of the UN.